seen in the past in Eli Manning. We've seen John Elway. But this is not a quarterback who is guaranteed to be the first QB off the board, number one. He's certainly not guaranteed to be the number one player in the draft going in. So you have other quarterbacks in this draft, like Sam Darnold, potentially, if he is in this draft. You have Drew Locke at Missouri, another junior who could come out early. Josh Allen came off a great performance in the bowl game for Wyoming. You have Mason Rudolph at Oklahoma State, and Baker Mayfield, oh, by the way, who could possibly play in two playoff games here coming up. It's a long way, and to basically come out and say, I wanted to go here, but I don't want to go there, I don't like that. I don't like to hear that type of thing this early or even that, or even late in the process, unless you are the guy that is up that high guaranteed, and by late April, you'll know that.
Former players now who analyze football who say this, a move like that is great for intelligence, the idea that he could tell you things about his former team. Do you put any stock into that aspect of when you sign a player, any player, and bring them?
We're playing the Jets this week. I don't really know what that has to do with it. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't know. Just play outside linebacker for his Steelers. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Carry over between what they asked him to do and what he might do in your scheme?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll start working with him, see how it goes.
Got his experience in big games at all a factor? I mean, you have big games ahead, obviously.
Yeah, we can't control any of that.
One of the best to play this game at the outside linebacker position. James has to do what James has to do. It's not like he called and asked me if he should or not. On James, if they want to ask him every single piece of information he has, then you know that's this league. I guess other people do that too. So I'm not worried about it. We don't play them this week. We don't play them next week. So we'll see.
It was a good game. Both teams, you know, had a hard-fought game, and they had a lot of transition points. They kicked our butt in transition. That was basically the telltale sign of the game for us in the loss. And obviously, you know, everybody's, you know, look at that offensive rebound by Bell and kick out to Clay for that three. You know, they kicked our butts in transition. I lost it on the left wing. It got me a little bit, but I lost that one. But the one right before, obviously, the overturn one, he found me twice. But whatever. What are you going to do about it?
There was a lot of debate on Twitter about whether that was a foul.
Twitter?
Did it feel clean? Did you get a replay of it, like, in your
It felt clean. It's probably the same play a bunch of those dudes on Twitter probably arguing about in 24-hour fitness that wasn't a foul. So they've been in that position before, but just not on Christmas at the Oracle Arena. So they know if they ain't called it, it's not a foul. But I'm sure if they get that call next week in 24-hour fitness, they're going to be p***ed that it was off, that they called a foul. So keep that shit on Twitter.
He'll look to Reggie Bullock for the corner gun. It doesn't go. Lance Stevenson with a rebound.
Reggie Jackson seriously hurt on the other end. He got up, tried to walk. He tried to walk, but could not put any pressure.
Ankle.
Yeah, couldn't put any pressure on that right ankle. Goes up and comes down right there and turns that ankle. Right there. My goodness.
Rolled it.
The x-rays were negative. He's got an ankle sprain. We'll get an MRI and see tomorrow sort of where we are. A relatively easy win. And other than Tobias, we didn't shoot the ball very well, particularly from distance. That's usually when we've had easier wins, and we struggled from there tonight. But we out-rebounded by 20 and, you know, played pretty good defense. We were able to get the job done.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Welcome to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Good Wednesday to you. It's 12 minutes after 3. We've got you until 5 o'clock in drive time right here on The Ticket. And we have got a lot of news to talk about today. Busy, busy indeed. Kush, normally we bleep press conferences. Normally we bleep things that players or coaches say, you know, into hot mics when they, you know, they get a moment of frustration or whatever the case might be.
Right, yeah.
We don't usually have to use the beeper to bleep out things that happen on the court or on the field to play. But I could have sworn I just heard a beep or bleep, if you will, during the actual play at the Pistons game. What, pray tell, was it that we had to beep out there?
Well, yes, you are hearing that correctly, and actually that means we were able to sneak both kinds in today because you heard there the Kevin Durant part, incidentally, from after Christmas. That was one of those post-game scenarios. No, this was between them talking during the broadcast of it. So first of all, that horrific-sounding scream you heard first, yeah, that was, in fact, Reggie Jackson falling down after he couldn't put any weight on that ankle right after he sprained it. And then because the announcers, Blaha and the rest weren't talking at that exact moment, you could clear as day. Here's some, well, I can't replay that word because I like our license.
What letter did it begin with? I'm curious.
That would be an F.
Have you ever screamed that as your first word when you're in a moment of pain or a moment of, you know, extreme trauma? Instead of, because in the movies, most of the time, it's, you know, it's a screech or a scream.
Right.
It doesn't take the shape of a word or the form of a word. Reggie's did. Reggie didn't just, and he didn't yell, damn. He yelled the, well, what is it in A Christmas Story that they just played for 24 straight hours right on TNT?
Yes, yeah, picture that scene, people.
The queen mother of all curse words, I think is how they referred to it. Fudge. Yeah, that's what he yelled. He yelled fudge. He wanted some fudge at that moment in time. No, that's too bad. That's obviously very disappointing for Pistons fans. And, oh, by the way, we do have an update on that.
Six to 8 weeks.
Yeah, 6 to 8 weeks with the grade 3 ankle sprain is what we found out today, of course. He'll be reevaluated at that point in time. Averaging 14.5 points, 44.6 shooting, and 5.5 assists a game. Needless to say, a big, big loss.
Yeah, he had a good game last night, too. He had something like 8 or 9 assists in like the first half alone.
Yeah, yeah. So that's going to sting. That's going to sting and sit with the Pistons for a while. Obviously, 6 to 8 weeks is a... You know, have to turn to Ish Smith for a lot more minutes and get some relief and get some help somewhere else. Well, we'll talk. That's the beauty of this, because I was about to ask Jim Cushman something we probably shouldn't, because we can ask Steve Hinson when he comes on with us coming up at about 4:10. He writes for DetroitBadBoys.com. I was going to say, any thoughts to adding somebody to the roster to replace, you know, a point guard, a free agent point guard, a street guy or somebody to replace Reggie, because we're not talking about a short period of time here. 6 to 8 weeks, by my count, that's nearly 2 months. If it goes to the 8, it is 2 full months.
That's end of February after the All-Star break,
yeah,
if it goes that far.
So, you know, that's a pretty significant piece of time there. So I'm just kind of curious what kinds of things they might do to bolster the point guard spot during that time. So we'll talk about that coming up in just a bit with Mr. Hinson. Oh, by the way, we will also talk a little bit on the Cleveland side of the NBA with Cavaliers writer and really all things Cleveland, Dennis Manilov. He'll join us at 3:35. We're going to talk about the Clowns and why Josh Rosen doesn't want to go to Cleveland, as if that's any big surprise. I bet you right now DeShone Kizer's thinking, damn, maybe I should have tried that. Maybe I should have played the don't draft me, I would rather go somewhere else and have it be right. I'd rather go later in the draft and be in the right place than go earlier in the draft and be in the wrong place. That's kind of the line that Josh Rosen was reported to have used to Adam Schefter over the weekend. And the UCLA quarterback is creating no fans in Northeast Ohio. And it's a question of now whether or not the Browns would ignore his, you know, public criticism of them and take him anyway if he is the highest rated QB on their board. Quite frankly, he's not the highest rated QB on my board anyway, but if he is on theirs, the question now becomes, do you take him anyway despite his public protesting, and do you hope that you can win him over when he comes in? So that's something we'll talk about with Manilov coming up a bit as well. James Harrison was a Steeler, is now a Patriot. You heard Big Ben in the montage there, among others, talking about whether or not he will take intel, you know, game plans, signals, formations, and everything else that he's got on the Steelers over and hand it to Bill Belichick, giving them an even bigger advantage. I swear to God, I don't like to do this, but is God a Patriots fan? Seriously, how many things have to break their way before it's not just a coincidence anymore? You know, Jesse James of the Steelers scores the winning touchdown, lunges over the goal line, breaks the plane, touchdown. Ball jostles a little bit when he lands in the end zone after having already broken the plane, and they say incomplete catch or incomplete pass. And then, of course, Roethlisberger throws the ill-advised fake spike interception, and the Patriots win home field advantage in the playoffs. Last weekend, of course, it happens yet again. I mean, the Buffalo Bills get screwed out of a touchdown catch for the exact same reason. It seems like whenever there is something controversial that breaks, it goes in the Patriots' favor. And in this case, the Steelers, clearly the biggest threat to the Patriots in the AFC to go back to the Super Bowl. One of their great all-time players, their franchise leader in sacks, is unhappy. He's not getting playing time. He's sitting behind the rookie, T.J. Watt, at his outside linebacker position. He's made himself a bit of a pain in the butt. He's demanded a trade or a release. He gets his release and immediately marches up to Foxborough and says, let's go, I got some stuff for you. It's just, you know, the windfall that continues to benefit Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. It's just an amazing thing how that continues. So we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Can I just say real quick on that one? And this is part of the reason I had to include some of those Belichick non-answers when he was asked about it from the Patriot reporters and everything. If I didn't know any better, that first line, and let me see if I can make sure this is queued up right. If I didn't know any better, he was asked, is it nice to have an intelligent player like that on your team? And if I didn't know any better, he was basically saying, there's no need to have intelligence against the Jets. And I find that hysterical.
Well, you're going to play it? I thought you were going to play it.
I got to cue this up. Hang
on. Oh, okay. Yeah, I would very much like to hear. I thought you had it queued up there. I thought that's what you were trying to say. Yeah, I would like to hear that. Because Bill Belichick's best answer, in my opinion, in that press conference when asked about Harrison and what he might be able to do for the Patriots when they meet the Steelers, he just deadpan looked at the reporter and said, "We play the Jets this week."
Yeah,
that's it.
Here we go. I got it queued up with the question.
Former players now who analyze football who say this, a move like that is great for intelligence, the idea that he could tell you things about his former team. Do you put any stock into that aspect of when you sign a player, any player, and bring them?
We're playing the Jets this week. I don't really know what that has to do with it.
Oh, there it is. There it is. No, Jim, I didn't take it the way you did at all. Because the first part was the part that mattered. We said, we play the Jets this week.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, what could James Harrison tell us about the Jets? We're here to talk about the Jets, not about the Steelers. We don't play the Steelers. We play the Jets this week. I didn't take it as we don't need any intelligence to beat the Jets. I think he meant very simply, what could James Harrison have for us that would be a benefit against the Jets?
It must have been something I was thinking of. You know, I must have been in a silly mood when I thought that, because for me, part of what I heard was an implication. Hey, they don't need intelligence against the Jets.
No, I didn't hear that at all. He's simply saying that this guy doesn't have any intelligence to share with us on the Jets, and since he played the Jets this week, why are you asking me about something else?
And that is probably exactly what he meant, and I must have just been in a funny mood, because that's how I heard it, and I just laughed.
but that line itself is the best line, you know, because it's like, and it's the right line, too.
Yes.
It's the right line. It's why you're asking
about that. I think
it's
the right line in either of our cases.
There will be a time to answer that, by the way. There will be a time when they face the Steelers, if they both get to that part of the postseason, which would be as the top two seeds, of course, would be in the championship game. He will have to answer that question. There's no doubt about it. It will resurface. But for now, and I guarantee you, you know, they're going to have a bye in the first round, obviously. But when they play their divisional round game, somebody's going to ask him, and he's going to again say the same thing. He's going to say it during the week of the bye, any press conferences they have. And he's going to say it the following week during the lead up to the divisional game. He's going to say, we're playing the X, not the Steelers, so why are you asking me about that?
And you're right. And by the way, it will be a while, because if I'm reading the standings right, barring something weird that I think is impossible anyway, both of these teams get byes to the divisional. Therefore, the only place they can meet up is with the Super Bowl on the line.
Correct, in the AFC Championship game. That's what I said. That's exactly when they would meet up, is in the AFC Championship game, because they're the top two seeds. So they would, you know, if they both win, you know, they wouldn't be able to play each other.
I thought they both clinched at least that, yeah.
Yes, they both have first-round byes. And they both have first-round byes, which means then they're going to play divisional games, and if they win those, then they'll be playing in the AFC Championship game. So that's kind of where I am. You might still be in a goofy mood. Did you just come from the dentist? You on laughing gas or something?
No.
Well, helium.
I am
in
one of those goofy moods today. I can't explain it.
Okay, all right, fair enough. But I want to get into something a little bit more serious, Jim. I want to invite people to talk about this at 866-240-1065. This has to do with the other team that we cover in the NFL, of course, which would be more closely anyway, the Detroit Lions, and have not had a chance since we were off on Christmas Monday, of course, and I was off yesterday as part of my little Christmas break, and you sat in for me. I haven't had a chance yet to opine on the Lions' dismal effort against the horrible Cincinnati Bengals. The Cincinnati Bengals, Jim, who are playing out the string, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Playing out the string for soon-to-be departing coach Marvin Lewis.
At least we assume soon-to-be departed.
Well, I mean, he said it.
Yeah.
He said he's done. He said he's leaving after the season. He's made the decision. So rather than being fired, he is essentially saying it's time for me and I'm moving on, and he's looking for other opportunities. So I have no reason to not believe him. Is that in doubt in some way, or did I miss something there, Jim?
Because no.
When he announced that he's done after the season, I assume he's done after the season.
No, I don't think you did, not at all. It's just there's, for some reason, something doesn't feel fully official about it to me, and I can't put my finger on it.
Well, the fact that he's still coaching, that's probably what it is, because he has one more game.
It's got to be part of it, I suppose.
But the Lions, you know, we're playing for their playoff lives, and even if they had won the last four games of the season, which they needed to do, after losing to Baltimore, they needed to beat Tampa, Chicago, Cincinnati, and Green Bay. Now they lose one of those four, so it's over. And then they still needed help after that, of course. The part about this that is very troubling to me is the article. And did you and Lemieux talk about what Joseph Hayes wrote in the Free Press yesterday at all?
No, I don't think we got to that one.
This is the troubling part about this. And it may very well explain why. We're about to delve into, for just a moment here, because like I said, we got Maniloff coming up. But briefly, we're about to delve into the race issues going on, you know, just in general here. Because a reporter has brought it up. And this is what so many people do. You know, it's a constant topic of discussion how many African-American head coaches or general managers there are in the National Football League. And it's believed by many there need to be more, to be more representative of the players in the league and all of this sort of thing. And aside from the in-depth conversation about all of that, how many should there be and what is the role of the Rooney rule as far as being required to interview African-American coaches and so on and so forth. One of the problems that I think a lot of people overlook when jobs come open, such as, and I think the Rooney Rule requires interviewing at least one African-American candidate for head coaching, offensive and defensive coordinator jobs, and front office jobs.
That's basically the gist of it, yeah.
One of the things people forget about is when an African-American coach is hired, it's impossible to criticize the owner or GM that has hired him of being racist. But when he is fired, the very same general manager can be accused of racism. Why are you firing him? Why isn't he being given a longer opportunity? Why isn't he being given? Isn't he being evaluated like white coaches would be? And it's why so often I firmly believe during the long period of time that we went, you know, before black quarterbacks became prevalent, and I think they certainly are. I mean, I don't think anybody in today's NFL looks at quarterbacks and says, white or black, smart or dumb, slow or fast. I don't think anybody buys into that stereotypical trash from the 60s or the 70s or whenever it was anymore. Quarterbacks are quarterbacks. They watch you play, and they evaluate your talent, and they talk to you, and they decide what you can do based on that. I don't think it's a skin thing anymore. And I feel like it isn't as much with coaches either, but I guarantee you that in that period of time in which black quarterbacks were hard to find and black coaches and coordinators were few and far between, there were a lot of owners who were afraid of hiring them or drafting them or acquiring them, because when the time came to part ways, there's going to be allegations of racism. It's a sad commentary, but it's a reality of this situation. And you know as well as I do, everybody listening to this program who's a sports fan knows, that in the sporting or in the coaching world, you are hired to be fired. Very, 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 very few people in Major League Baseball, the National Basketball Association, National Football League, very few coaches are so good and so dominant that they can dictate the terms of their own departure. Very few. Almost everybody else, whether it's 2 years later or it's 5 years later or it's 9 years later, almost everybody is fired. You're hired to be fired in this business. If you win a championship, it buys you a long grace period afterwards. But if you aren't contending for another one within a period of 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years, you're going to be fired too. And so when you are hired to be fired, there are a lot of coaches, or excuse me, bosses, general managers, owners and so on and so forth, who don't want to have to face questions like this. And yet here we are. Joseph Haynes, writing this article that ran in the Free Press. He writes for the Times Herald, which I guess is part of the ownership group, Gannett, that owns the Free Press. And he wrote this piece that ran on Yesterday. Ran yesterday. Sorry, it was the 26th. For some reason, I thought this ran over the weekend, but it didn't. And the headline tells it all. Joseph Hayes says Detroit Lions coach Jim Caldwell's hot seat tied to racism. It's been difficult to watch how Detroit Lions coach Jim Caldwell has been treated, he says. Caldwell became the first African-American coach in Lions history when it took over in 2014. What has followed has been historic success for the Lions and plenty of disrespect from the fans and the local media. And that is because those fans and local media don't like black coaches, is essentially the argument that he is making here. I find that to be staggering in its ignorance. I find it to be beyond provocative. I find it to be trolling, Twitter style, but for a major market newspaper. The height of irresponsibility, and without any evidence whatsoever to suggest that people are tired of Jim Caldwell because he's a black coach, not just because he's a coach that can't get his team into the playoffs and win a playoff game. And when he does have an opportunity to get back to the playoffs and squanders it with some very, very poor play, it's because he's black. These are the kinds of questions, these are the kinds of problems that so many people in the National Football League don't want to deal with. It's why they have a hard time. And can anybody ever call the Lions ownership or general manager Bob Quinn racist? For crying out loud. And I know Quinn didn't hire Caldwell, but he had a choice when he came in about changing coaches and said, no, I want to roll with Caldwell and I want to see what we can do together. But when they make choices to hire them, it should alleviate any allegations of racism. When people cheer him for winning 11 games and going into the playoffs, it should alleviate any allegations of racism. But when he then loses and doesn't make the playoffs in back-to-back seasons, or if he doesn't make the playoffs and win a football game and then comes up short of the playoffs, or I'm sorry, if he makes playoffs and comes up short, and then the next year comes up short of the playoffs altogether, if people are booing him and calling for a change, that can't be because he's black either. Nobody cheered him for being black when he won. Nobody's booing him for being black when he loses. It's a results-oriented business. If he puts his team in the playoffs, wins a couple of games, and is on the verge of the Super Bowl, do you think there are going to be people giving half-hearted golf claps? Yeah, I guess. But he's black. No, they're going to be screaming their bloody head off and wearing their Honolulu blue morning, day, morning, noon, and night. But because he's struggling now, and they're struggling, and they're very much underperforming, and 9-7 might just not be good enough, which is essentially the question here. Is it better than 4-12? Yes. Is it better than 0-16, which it was 9 years ago? Yes. Is it good enough? No. 8-8, 9-7 isn't good enough to win a Super Bowl, and that's what fans want to see. It doesn't make them racist to want to see better than what they're getting. And when media personnel do this sort of thing, they do a great disservice to everybody, including Jim Caldwell. Because then they suddenly make him, without his request, without his permission, they make him the face of a cause, the face of a movement that may not have anything to do with how he feels about it. And by the way, I will say this about Jim Caldwell. God bless the honesty of this man. Because he addressed that question. And he denied that his race has anything to do with the way that he is covered. Jim Caldwell is the picture of class in this situation. And not because he's black. And if he was white, it wouldn't be because he's white. It's because he's a good person who is telling the truth. The scumbag in this situation is a reporter who would try this nonsense. A writer who's trying to play the race card and to try to advance the cause of black coaches everywhere by martyring one who he thinks isn't being given a fair shake simply because of his race. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. We've got to get a bottom of the hour sports center now, and then we got Maniloff coming up, and I will talk about this before 5 o'clock. Make sure you're with us. 866-240-1065. Kush, let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
NFL announced early yesterday there will not be a game flexed into the Wednesday, to the Week 17 Sunday night slot. Why? Well, as we know, That's going to be New Year's Eve this Sunday. As a result, 2017 becomes the first NFL season since 1977 where there was not a Sunday night football game to cap off the regular season in its final week of play. 1977, incidentally, was also the final season of the 14-game NFL schedule. So 40 years between Sunday night games to wrap up the regular season that the league will not have one. So there it is, your Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day. Maniloff joins us to talk NFL and more coming up next.
Right to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling right along on the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. As promised, time to talk NFL football and maybe a little bit of basketball as well. With our good friend Dennis Maniloff, who covers all of Cleveland sports out there for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. D-Man, good to have you back, my brother. First of all, Merry Christmas, belatedly, and Happy New Year a little bit early.
Same to you, Bob, and thank you for having me on.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you on, Dennis, and there's a lot of stuff to get to, and I want to talk about the kind of interesting and maybe moderately controversial move of James Harrison from the Steelers to the Patriots just a few weeks before they could be and probably should be facing one another in the AFC Championship game. But, of course, we have to talk about the Clowns of Cleveland as they continue their march toward history. They will become the second team when the Steelers pound the daylights out of them on Sunday to go 0-16 in an NFL season. The third team to go winless overall when you count the 0-14 1976 Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So let me just go there, first of all. Do you think that after the performance we saw against the Chicago Bears, that Jimmy Haslam is rethinking in any way, shape, or form his public commitment 3 weeks ago to keeping Hugh Jackson for the 2018 season?
I don't see how he couldn't, Bob. And if he's not reconsidering it, John Dorsey is asking him to or imploring him to, because it just doesn't seem logical to me that a 1-31 coach would have job security going forward. 1-31 with that particular franchise. So, I think that all bets are off if this team goes 0-16 as you predict it will and as I predict it will. I don't know that the degree of the loss on Sunday would be automatic, you know, to force a reconsideration. In other words, if the Steelers were to rout them, is that the final nail, if you will? I don't know about that. I just think that it's very difficult to ask a new general manager whom you trust, you know, with a lot of important decisions to inherit a 1-31 coach.
Dennis, let me ask you a what if. You said what if the Steelers rout him? How does that impact the decision, you know, to pile on the embarrassment of an 0-16 season to get routed? What if they don't rout him? But what if it's Landry Jones instead of Ben Roethlisberger and whoever their backup tailback is and not Le'Veon Bell? They're already without Antonio Brown. What if the Steelers B team ends up beating the Browns, whether convincingly or narrowly? Is that just as embarrassing as if the A team played them and routed them?
Well, I would think so. But then again, what happened last year, I think I remember it was Landry Jones. They won it with Jones against Griffin. So, you know, I don't know about that, Bob, but I will say this. Well, the other thing, too, is if it is the backups or if the backups are the ones that lead the Steelers, Jackson would simply say, see, I told you, there's nothing I can do with this roster. There's nothing I can do with this roster. We can't even beat the B team. You know, that has already been sewn into the fabric by Hugh Jackson, that he doesn't have the players. John Dorsey has said it. So those would seem to be, you know, marks in favor of Jackson. But the problem is, how does a 1-31 coach garner the respect that he needs going forward, with the franchise?
You know, one of the things that the Jackson supporters continue to say is, well, the team continues to play hard for him. So therefore, that's a sign that they respect him. I don't know that I've ever heard anything as ridiculous as that. these guys aren't playing hard for him. They're playing hard for their careers. They're a bunch of crappy players on a crappy franchise with a crappy organization with a crappy owner and a crappy front office until Dorsey, and we'll see whether that becomes crappy or not, who are trying to keep a spot in the league. If they don't stay in Cleveland, they're hoping to play. Guys going out there, they're playing for paychecks, and they're playing for their next job. They're not playing for a coach. Do you find that as insulting as I do to say, well, there's proof that he's doing something right because the players keep playing hard?
Pretty much, Bob. Yes, I agree with you almost wholeheartedly. I've never understood the idea. It sounds to me as an excuse, not even an explanation. Professional athletes trying hard, not quitting, so they should be rewarded for it, or people surrounding them should be rewarded for the fact that those guys are, they continue to try even though they continue to lose. As you pointed out, the bottom line is they're getting paid, and they're not sitting here worried about the record as much as they are, is the check going to clear? And as long as it does, then you shouldn't reward them or applaud them for the extra effort or the whatever close to 100% effort that they give despite losing.
We're talking to Dennis Manilow, a little NFL talk, talking about the Browns ready to put the cap on a 0-16 season, a 1-31 record, the worst 2-year record in the history of the National Football League. You can just continue to go on with the numbers as far as how much they have lost. It's beyond embarrassing. I mean, it should be franchise crippling, franchise killing. But Dennis, the franchise does go on, and they're going to have the first pick in the draft, and then they're going to have the what, 6th pick in the draft as well. And a lot of people, of course, are saying that DeShone Kizer's experiment was exactly that. It was a failure, the experiment. I think that's unfair, but it is what it is. And that they're going to take another quarterback this time with the number one overall pick, something they have been reticent to do for the last several years under various administrations. But one of the guys that apparently does not want to be considered for that number one overall pick is Josh Rosen, the very talented quarterback out of UCLA, who made some comments over the last few days about, I would rather go lower and be with the right team than go higher and be with the wrong team. And it's pretty doggone clear what he means. He would rather go number 2 overall to the Giants than to go number 1 overall to the place where quarterbacks go to die, which is Cleveland, Ohio. Do you have any problem with Rosen stating that out loud without saying the word Cleveland? He made it about as clear as you can. Do you have any problem with his feelings on that? And should the Browns say, I don't care what you say, if we want you, we're taking you?
You know what, Bob? It may sound counterintuitive, but I'm answering your question yes to both. First of all, I don't have a problem with Rosen, voicing his opinion. He's allowed to say that. It's a free country. He's allowed to say, look, I prefer play on a better team. I don't begrudge him that, but I'll tell you what, I also don't, if I'm the Browns, I don't give a daggone, okay? I mean, if I'm John Dorsey and I rate Rosen as my number one player, certainly my number one quarterback, knowing this team needs a QB and I want to draft him number one overall, I don't care what Josh Rosen thinks, okay? As far as I can tell, he doesn't have leverage, like, for example, John Elway did with baseball. And I'm going to choose him anyway. And what's he going to do? Sit and sulk, with my team for a year. So certainly Rosen is entitled to his opinion. He's allowed to voice his opinion. And the Browns are also allowed to take it under advisement, ignore it, and go ahead and draft him anyway if they believe he's their best option.
Dennis, John Dorsey is very interesting in this scenario now, because not of what he has said since getting the Browns job, but something he said before ever taking this job. There's a story on The Big Lead, which is thebiglead.com, which I believe is USA Today. No, that's not USA Today. I beg your pardon. I'm trying to get all of these different media outlets together. But at any rate, it's thebiglead.com. And they cite Adam Schefter, of course, we knew on Sunday, who said that Josh Rosen, said he would rather not play for the Browns and, in fact, would even consider going back to school rather than being drafted by Cleveland, as they say, where the careers of quarterbacks go to die. A secondary report says that John Dorsey was one of the sources cited in a November draft report by Tony Pauline that said that included this blurb on Josh Rosen, quote, "When speaking about the signal caller, at least two general managers have said, stay away." This is, again, from Rosen. One general manager, whose team will likely end up with a top 12 selection and needs a quarterback, said he would not select him from his early off-the-field evaluations. Opinions are that Rosen is not the leader they need on the field for the next level. The things he's gotten away with on the college level won't fly in the NFL. The word egotistical was mentioned many times in referring to Rosen. Well, Pauline is now saying that Dorsey was one of those two sources who said, do not, you don't want to go near Josh Rosen. So this might be a very mutual feeling here. Rosen says to the Browns, don't take me, I don't want to be there. And John Dorsey is, you know, essentially would have said even preemptively, don't worry, we don't want you.
Yeah, it's entirely possible, Bob. And, I mean, again, I if I'm Dorsey and I did that, if I was the source there, then obviously I don't like Rosen as much as some people do. But the one thing I'm not going to allow, if I'm Dorsey, is anything that comes out of any one of these guys' mouths about, I don't want to play for you, or, you know, any sort of that insinuation or intimation that you don't want to play for. I don't care. I don't care whether you want to play for me or not. I totally get why you would look at my franchise and say it's moribund and it's woebegone and it's laughable and it's all this, but I don't care. I'm going to take you anyway if, in fact, I do want you, because I have that right. And I'm going to let the chips fall where they may after that.
How do you feel about him? Would you want him? Would you want him after having said that? And consider that part, as well as what you have seen on the football field. I don't know if you do a draft board, if you've got a ranking of quarterbacks. I don't know where you put him compared to Sam Darnold, or where you put him next to Allen, or any of the other guys, or even to the Heisman Trophy winner Baker Mayfield. But based on what you see from him on the field and what you hear from him off of the field, would you take him?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen enough. I really haven't watched a lot of UCLA. I mean, I'd say maybe over his course of his career, I've watched 5 games that he's played,
right?
And I totally agree with those who say it's a, you know, it's a beautiful ball. He throws a nice ball and all that. He looks like a professional when he's out there. I don't know much about his off the field stuff. I've read what most people have, but I haven't, you know, done a deep dive into Josh Rosen. So you know, I think he's a really intriguing pro prospect. He deserves to be at the high end of draft boards, but are you automatically going to tell me that he's a better prospect than Sam Darnold long term? I don't know. I mean, or another guy, Josh Allen or somebody else. So I'm not, in other words, I don't think the key, I guess, is I don't think Rosen is some slam dunk, unbelievable, once in a generational quarterback talent that I have to have or else.
Dennis, let's talk about current football today. James Harrison released by the Steelers over the weekend, apparently at Harrison's request. Very upset that he has been only active in 5 games this year while completely healthy. You know, lost his spot to rookie T.J. Watt. Wanted an opportunity to get out. They let him go, and then he immediately goes to New England. Number one, is there any kind of a breach of competitive etiquette there to go right to the team that you are probably, your old team, is probably going to play for the AFC Championship? Is there any fault in Harrison's there? And secondly, how badly do you think the Steelers screwed up here? I mean, why wouldn't they just say, sorry, you'll get your release at the end of the year. We're not going to release you now and have you potentially go to somewhere. Even if you go to an NFC team, we might play in a, you know, prospective Super Bowl. No, we can't let you walk out of here with all of your years of experience, knowing everything, every one of our defensive calls, knowing every one of our offensive calls by standing out there and defending the first team offense every practice. No, we're not going to let you leave. I just feel like it was a monumental mistake by the Steelers to allow James Harrison to leave and now take whatever intel he chooses and hand it to Bill Belichick.
Well, regarding part one, I don't think it's a breach of competitive etiquette. As long as Kevin Durant can leave Oak City and go to Golden State, I guess all bets are off. Anybody can go anywhere, even if it's the arch rival. So
little different, though, in my opinion. A little different. Because there's not much intel. I mean, I think everybody in Golden State already knows how good Russell Westbrook is. I don't think Kevin Durant's going to share anything with them. But I'm talking about from a, you know, this is a guy who's a very intelligent guy, James Harrison, who can, you know, in 3 weeks from now or 4 weeks from now, when they play for the AFC Championship game, he could be standing on the sidelines telling Tom Brady every single thing that the Steelers defense does. It's from that standpoint more than just a Hayes playing for them.
Okay, but still, I don't begrudge Harrison for signing with the New England. I mean, he wants a ring, and the Patriots are the best odds to get it. And he also is now, because he was released, he's now furious with the Steelers, so he wants to take out the max punishment on the Steelers. What better way to do that than to join the Patriots? So,
okay, now what about the Steelers' side of all of this? Is this, I mean, are they just... I cannot believe what a gaffe this is, that they would let him go and open up this possibility, because he knew it was such a Belichick thing to do. You know, a guy who videotapes other teams' walkthroughs and all of the competitive advantages Belichick gets. Did they not think that if we give Harrison his outright release and he clears waivers, that Belichick is going to reel him in? I mean, what are they thinking?
On the surface, it looks to me like an unforced error by the Steelers. And it's one that I don't understand why they would, you know, why it would happen, why they would allow it to happen. Again, but we don't know the whole story. I mean, maybe Harrison did something outrageous behind the scenes that, you know, forced their hand. We don't know. But on the surface, it seems like something that the Steelers did not have to do. And they created this mess for themselves.
Yeah, it really does. The one thing that there was an Instagram video that Harrison posted of him working out, and you know what a beast of a workout warrior he is, and he's just working out, and he's just, you know, he's jacked to the max, and he's looking at the camera and saying, "How can they keep this on the sidelines? Huh? How can they keep this on the sidelines?" So, you know, kind of a public calling out of Tomlin and the defensive coaching staff for not giving him time and giving him snaps. Maybe that does it, but again, I still kind of feel like I would say, look, James, we know you want to go someplace else, but you're with us through the end of this one, okay, pal? Just be a good teammate, because I think they may have shot themselves in the foot here. Dennis, we're short on time, but real quick before we get to the top of the hour, Kevin Durant beat LeBron James head-to-head again, did it without Steph Curry. We saw it happen on Christmas Day. LeBron had a poor shooting night, defended by James virtually the entire game, had 7 turnovers as well. Aside from the late game non-foul calls, just looking at it for 48 minutes and looking back at what we saw in the finals where Kevin Durant was the MVP of the series, has he closed the gap against LeBron James for best player on the planet?
I thought you were going to ask me, do the Cavs still have a problem with the Golden State Warriors? And I would say definitively yes.
You can answer that too.
Yeah, I mean, regarding Durant, I still believe LeBron will be the best player on the planet for a long time, as long as he wants to play almost, because I don't think he'll settle for a second-level talent. He'll walk away before that. So is Durant closing the gap? I don't know. I think Durant is still incredibly good. He's a top 10 player in the league for sure, but I don't know that he's knocking on James's door. What I take from that game, though, is that the issues that the Warriors present remain a problem for the Cavaliers. I think adding Crowder and Green to run at Durant is a good thing. That's an improvement. And I know that the Cavs will say, well, Golden State didn't have Curry, we didn't have Thomas, but I don't think you can make that a Washington Curry's better than Thomas, especially in that matchup. I don't see how Thomas gets his shot off against those guys. The length of the Warriors has not gone away. The depth of the Warriors has not gone away. And the bottom line is the Cavaliers have still not figured out how to score, quote-unquote, easy baskets against Golden State, which you have to have if you're going to beat them. You've got to find a way to score, not only on breakaways, on fast breaks, but also get routine shots in half-court sets that are not hurried and that are not partially blocked or whatever, and the Cavs still have not figured out how to solve that riddle with the Warriors.
Good stuff. Dennis Maniloff, we are out of time, my friend. Great stuff, great analysis of the NFL and the NBA. We look forward to talking to you again sometime in 2018, and I'm guessing very, very early in 2018, sometime early next week. Dennis, thanks so much for the time, my friend.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it.
You got it. Dennis Maniloff there, talking a little Cavaliers, talked a little NFL. We're going to stay in the NBA circles here because coming up after the top of the hour SportsCenter we got coming your way, we talked to Steve Hinson, DetroitBadBoys.com, about the Pistons. That'll be at about 4:10. Reggie Jackson going to be out for a while. How much is this going to impact the Motor City Bad Boys? So that'll be coming up at about 4:10. So that's coming up after the top of the hour SportsCenter, beg your pardon, which is next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We've seen in the past in Eli Manning, we've seen John Elway, but this is not a quarterback who is guaranteed to be the first QB off the board, number one. He's certainly not guaranteed to be the number one player in the draft going in. So you have other quarterbacks in this draft, like Sam Darnold, potentially, if he is in this draft. You have Drew Locke at Missouri, another junior who could come out early. Josh Allen came off a great performance in the bowl game for Wyoming. You have Mason Rudolph at Oklahoma State, and Baker Mayfield, oh, by the way, could possibly play in two playoff games here coming up. It's a long way, and to basically come out and say, I wanted to go here, but I don't want to go there, I don't like that. I don't like to hear that type of thing this early or even late in the process, unless you are the guy that is up that high guaranteed, and by late April, you'll know that.
Former players now who analyze football who say this, a move like that is great for intelligence, the idea that he could tell you things about his former team. Do you put any stock into that aspect of when you sign a player, any player, and bring them?
We're playing at Chet's this week. I don't really know what that has to do with it. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't know. Just play outside linebacker for his Steelers. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Carry over between what they asked him to do and what he might do in your scheme?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll start working with him, see how it goes.
That is experience in big games at all a factor? I mean, you have big games ahead, obviously.
Yeah, we can't control any of that.
He's one of the best to play this game at the outside linebacker position. James has to do what James has to do. It's not like he called and asked me if he should or not. On James, if they want to ask him every single piece of information he has, then you know that's what this league. I guess other people do that too. So I'm not worried about it. We don't play them this week. We don't play them next week. So we'll see.
No, it was a good game. Both teams, you know, had a hard-fought game, and they had a lot of transition points. They kicked our butt in transition. That was basically the telltale sign of the game for us in the loss. And obviously, you know, everybody, you know, look at that offensive rebound by Bale and kick out to Clay for that three. You know, they kicked our butts in transition. I lost it on the left wing. It got me a little bit, but I lost that one. But the one right before, obviously, the overturn one, he found me twice. But whatever. What are you going to do about it?
There was a lot of debate on Twitter about whether that was a foul.
Twitter?
Did it feel clean? Did you get a replay of it, like, in your mind?
It felt clean. It's probably the same play a bunch of those dudes on Twitter probably arguing about in 24-hour fitness that wasn't a foul. So they've been in that position before, but just not on Christmas at the Oracle Arena. So they know if they ain't call it, it's not a foul. But I'm sure if they get that call next week in 24-hour fitness, they're going to be p***ed that it was off, that they called a foul. So keep that shit on Twitter.
No looks to Reggie Bullock for the corner gun. It doesn't go. Lance Stevenson with a rebound.
Reggie Jackson seriously hurt on the other end. He got up, tried to walk. He tried to walk, but could not put any pressure.
Ankle.
Yeah, couldn't put any pressure on that right ankle. Goes up and he comes down right there and turns that ankle. Right there, my goodness.
Rolled it.
The x-rays were negative. He's got an ankle sprain. We'll get an MRI and see tomorrow sort of where we are. A relatively easy win. And other than Tobias, we didn't shoot the ball very well, particularly from distance. That's usually when we've had easier wins, and we struggled from there tonight. But we out-rebounded by 20 and, you know, played pretty good defense. We were able to get the job done.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling onward, 13 minutes after 4. By my count, that leaves us with 47 minutes of outstanding awesome left. And then we'll bring you some drive time right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks for being with us. So we talked a little bit about Cleveland basketball by way of the Cavaliers. Our friend Dennis Maniloff last segment. Time to talk a little bit about the Detroit Pistons. The Bad Boys doing work. I mean, team streak, I called it before, a seven-game losing streak now followed by a run of five wins in their last six games. They just continue to be either red hot or ice cold. And right now, they're in, you know, notwithstanding the loss to the Mavericks a few days ago, but they already have won five of their last six. Question is how many of their next 2 months are they going to win without point guard Reggie Jackson, who is out for 6 to 8 weeks per the Detroit Pistons? Joining us now to break it down is our friend Steve Hinson from DetroitBadBoys.com, a part of SB Nation. Steve, thanks for the time, man. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. How are you?
Oh, to you too. Doing well out here. All good.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for spending the time a little bit with us. And you know, Reggie has been playing good basketball. 14.5 points per game, shooting about 44%, handing out about 5.5 dimes a game. How big of a loss is this for the next 2 months? 6 weeks minimum. You know, potentially a full 2 months.
Well, it you know, it could certainly go either way. I mean, Reggie certainly has been playing so much better than he did last year. It'll be interesting to see how they go with the point guard rotation. It seemed like Stan Van Gundy had been looking for opportunities to put Langston Galloway in a ball handling situation, and he had played really. It seemed like the team had worked with him in that role. So, and of course, Ish Smith is big-time spark plug, so it seems like they could keep things going in the meantime. But just with all of these rotation guys who are injured, I mean, you've got Avery Bradley and John Luer also out. It's no more.
yeah, you can't really afford to have any more bodies dropping, especially important guys, including the guys that you just mentioned. But Reggie in particular, because of what you said, you know, he quite frankly, had a lousy year last year with, you know, without, you know, being blunt about it, without trying to sugarcoat it. He had a lousy year. I think he would probably admit that he has really turned it on and turned it around and played more like the Reggie Jackson he knows he can be this year. And the question isn't just how do they survive without him. And you say, you know, Ish Smith will probably take over the starting point guard duties, although, as you mentioned, Galloway can certainly get a lot of minutes there as well. But it's not just how do they survive without him. It's how does he come back. And how well is he able to shake off 2 months of rust potentially right around, you know, the end of February, start of March, when we really get into the stretch drive and push toward the playoffs?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I was thinking about it earlier today when that number came out for Reggie Jackson being out 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Isn't that about the same timeline we heard for his knee injury last year?
Ooh, and then you don't want to. Oh, that's a comparison I hadn't really thought of, but you're right. You're right. That's a good point.
And then, of course, those first 2 months with Reggie, you know, just Stan Van Gundy was giving him all the opportunities to work his way back into being healthy, but without that explosiveness and that athleticism, he just was never the same player. And so there's really not a whole lot of room for experimentation when it comes to that playoff maneuvering time in March and April. So they're really going to have to make sure that he comes back 100% before he's out on the court.
You know, I'm not a doctor, and I don't really want to play one on the radio, but it does seem like a long time to come back from a sprain. Now, grade 3, I assume, and Kush, fill in the missing pieces here if you know, grade 1 is the most mild, grade 3 is the most severe, or is grade 1 the high one, and 3 is not so bad?
By my looking up real quick, guys, grade 3 is the severe, so that would be the worst one, I think.
Okay, because I was going to say, normally a sprained ankle takes a couple of weeks, not 6 to 8, so I'm wondering exactly how severely sprained this thing is. I mean, are we talking about ligaments stretched to the point where maybe they could have torn and just shy of that? So that, because that really is a long time to go. You mentioned how he was out about that same time frame with the knee before. I'm hoping and counting on a full recovery so that when 6 to 8 weeks goes by, he is just as explosive on that ankle as he was beforehand. Because if it is a repeat of last year, boy, the way that impacted him after he came back, that's bad news.
Absolutely. I think it's one of those situations where they're going to need to be looking at the playoffs and looking at the long-term picture where Reggie Jackson may not be a part of it for this year. If he's not really able to get back to that explosiveness, and then they really don't have the opportunity to put him out in a position where he's going to fail like they did last year. And so it might be worth thinking about what this picture is going to look like without Reggie Jackson for the rest of the season.
And you know what, guys? If I could jump in, part of that picture I'm looking at is my thinking is, how is this going to affect the bench more than Ish Smith being in the starting lineup? Because quite frankly, we actually kind of know what the Pistons with Ish Smith as the starting point guard looks like. It's not that bad. But what's this going to do for them, the bench depth of this team, especially in the backcourt? And does something like this now spur the
Pistons? Because he's such a spark, right? I mean, Smith is a spark off of that bench. Yeah.
Yes, and so therefore, not just that with the bench itself, but what changes might this portend to in terms of the Pistons going out and getting somebody? There's a little under 2 months until the deadline.
It's one of those things where personnel is definitely something that should be on the table. We were chatting about this on with the DBB crew that I think that there's one open roster spot right now, so they could be able to potentially look at addressing it through a signing without having to drop one of these guys like Eric Moreland, who has also been really good off the bench too. But it does definitely seem like they need to shore up that point guard depth just to get through these next 2 months, unless if they really feel good about, how do you pronounce his name, Bjux?
Kush?
Dwight Bjux, the two-way player that we saw.
The whole time, guys.
We're all guessing on that one.
That is the first time I've ever seen a guy with two Ys in his last name.
that does make things difficult a little bit.
But if he's a potential solution there, then cool. But if not, and then they may need to throw some more bodies out there.
Yeah.
But also one.
Please go ahead.
The other thing about what Jim was mentioning with the dynamic for the bench is where's the offense going to come from? If we're looking for too much out of Reggie Bullock and guys like Stanley Johnson and Luke Kennard, who none of those guys have really shown a great ability to be aggressive offensively, that's a spot where Reggie Jackson will certainly be missed.
We're talking to Steve Henson, who writes about the Pistons for DetroitBadBoys.com. Real quick, Steve, there is a story on the website right now about the new jerseys. The Pistons have unveiled the new Motor City jerseys as part of their Nike City Edition, which is kind of cool, and I'm looking at them, and they are certainly very different. I actually kind of like it, to be honest with you. What I find very interesting, though, if you notice, is, and Jim, have you seen these yet, Kush?
I did catch a glimpse of them earlier today, yes.
Three stripes going down the side. Three very Adidas-looking stripes going down the sides of their Nike City Edition jerseys. I find that fascinating with all of the brand awareness between Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, and the like. It's incredible to me. They've got three Nike or Adidas stripes. I mean, just looks like every pair of Adidas pants you've ever seen, and their shoes, their three stripes on down each side. But what I was going to ask you, Steve, is what does it take to get clearance from the NBA to wear Motor City instead of, you know, Detroit on your alternative jerseys like this? Do you know what it takes?
You know, I've never heard much about that. It's certainly been a couple of years now since they started with that Chrome Sundays when we first saw those Motor City jerseys released, but I'm not really sure what it takes from the NBA in particular.
The only reason I ask, it might seem like a really weird question, and I'm sure it is, but the only reason I ask is there is no such city as Motor City. It's clearly a nickname for Detroit. And if they're greenlighting nicknames in the league office for, and I think this is going to be worn 9 times from what I'm seeing in the article, not your article, Sean Corp's article, but it's going to be worn 9 times this season. If they're taking nicknames, I'm just wondering, with a reference to your website, when they can get a jersey that just says Bad Boys. They got to get an alternate jersey that just says Bad Boys, Pistons Bad Boys, right?
That one, I would be 100% on that bandwagon. What do we need to do to make that happen?
I don't know, Kush. I don't know what it takes. I don't know, you know, if they have to petition the league, you know, if the owners have to go in and say, hey, we want to do an alternative jersey thing with our partnership with Nike. We want to call ourselves Motor City. You know, it's kind of like when they do L.A., you know, they do the Spanish version of it, like it'll say Los Lakers or something.
I've seen that with the Spurs and the Heat in the past too. Yeah. But that's something that to me is a little bit different than the Motor City one. And yeah,
I don't know what
up there with the Pistons PR has to start making some calls.
Yeah,
I doubt they're listening. I wish they would, because no, Motor City possibly opens that door, because they'd be one of the few teams that could get away with that kind of nickname too, because of the harkening back to that great period.
Exactly right. That's what I'm saying. If they can put Motor City on there, they sure as hell can do the other half of it and put Bad Boys on there, Motor City Bad Boys, and just put that on there. I just think it would be really, really cool. It would be very trendy, something that I think fans would get behind. And who knows, it might open the floodgates to all kinds of other things for other franchises. But I just think, you know, that's so iconic with the Pistons and their championship years and so on. I just feel like.
And you know what's interesting, too, on a side note, this kind of concept is probably best to be introduced through the NBA. Even, you know, say for hypothetical sake of argument, other sports down the line decide to pick this up. The NBA, for some reason, feels like the perfect one to try to start that. Because I don't think it would work as much with baseball, you know, jerseys. That's too classic. You don't really
did what baseball did. I mean, baseball isn't just relying on classic, tradition or whatever. Because remember what they did is they allowed nicknames for the players on the back of the jerseys for one weekend
weekend, Sierra, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah, and you know you could have whatever your nickname is on the back, which was really kind of cool as well. I think it's kind of fun. I think it's really connecting with fans when you do this sort of thing. And I'm sure fans in Detroit love the Motor City jerseys, but I'm just looking to take it to the next level there. And let's get Bad Boys on there maybe for a few games next year. That's why I asked Steve if he knew how the whole thing worked with the NBA. But if you ever do find out, if you ever feel the need to reach out and research that, Steve, report back to us and let us know what it takes to get the NBA to greenlight a nickname like that, because I think that would be something.
Sure thing, will do, and I agree. That's a great idea.
So back to the matter at hand here with the Pistons. I wanted to ask about Tobias Harris and Kush. I'm a little bit disappointed in you more than most days, and I'm usually disappointed in you most days. So that says something.
Oh, Lord, what did I do now?
Well, you gave us our Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day before, and it was about NFL and Sunday night games on New Year's Eve, when this one very well could have been the stat of the day. Tobias Harris is now the third player to shoot 90% or better in a game in which he took at least 8 threes. Hmm. The other two, Sam Perkins, who did it for the Sonics way back in 1997, and then Danny Green did it for the Spurs 5 years ago in 2012. That's according to Elias. That's a pretty damn cool stat right there.
That is.
90% or better in a game in which he took at least 8 threes. Tobias Harris had that going on. Tell us where we are offensively and sharing the scoring load now, especially as we talk about Reggie Jackson being out. How much more is Tobias Harris going to have to step up? How much more can Andre Drummond step up, although he's already doing some really great things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's going to be the big question that we see going forward over the next few games. Tobias Harris, he has had some stretches where he's been able to be more of a go-to guy, but it seemed like over the past few weeks that he's not quite been on that same on-fire type of mentality that he was early on in the season. So we'll definitely need to be leaning on him to get his shots up and also for those to still be good high-quality shots. But the other part of that equation is one of the things that when we do operate through Tobias Harris so much, sometimes that can get into that whole issue of, Tobias is going to be finishing it. He's not necessarily going to be creating for his teammates. And so some of the other guys on the court, like Stanley Johnson and Reggie Bullock, are they going to be able to be effective as complementary players in that type of situation?
The interesting thing about that, Steve, is in the game in question, in which, the rout of the Pacers, Tobias took the third most shots among the starters. Andre Drummond shot 13 times in that game on his way to 21 and 18. Bullock shot it 13 times on his way to 11 points. And Harris only shot it, Harris shot it 11 times on his way to 30. He was 10 for 11, 7 for 8 from 3. 3 for 4 in free throws. Also added 6 rebounds, just for 6 rebounds to throw in for good measure. So 30 points on 10 of 11 and 7 out of 8. So he didn't even need to finish that many times in order to lead that team in scoring. That's certainly not going to happen every day, so your point is a valid one. But clearly, points need to be made up, and somebody is going to have to really pick up their game and on the offensive end while Reggie is down.
Mm-hmm. And the funny thing, the interesting thing about that Pacers game was Tobias came out playing so hot, scoring 21 points in that first quarter, outscoring the Pacers as a whole. And then for the rest of the game, let's see, he only scored 8 points. He only got 4 shot attempts after that, after scoring 21 points in that first quarter. Yeah. So it seemed like sometimes they can get hot and cold with him, where they can really look to get him involved, and then other times he can kind of turn into a wallflower.
Yeah, Ish Smith, by the way, just again, since he's going to be so integral to how they survive and respond without Reggie Jackson in that game, he was 6 for 11 for 12 points. So, again, more than 50% from the floor, and he'll have to obviously keep that up. Real quick, just a couple of quick NBA thoughts from you on the Eastern Conference side of things, Steve, as we kind of approach the new year, and we're about a month away from the All-Star break. We're still in the first half of the season, but Cavaliers still far and away the favorite to go back to the finals again, or has Boston closed that gap at all to the point where, or Washington or anybody else, is there anybody in the East that can say, hey, we have a legitimate chance in seven games against the Cavaliers to have somebody else representing the Eastern Conference?
I still think the Cavs should be the odds-on favorite. They've certainly turned things around since their slow start. But one team that has sort of thrust themselves up into that conversation has been the Raptors. They're up to 23-9 now. They've been kind of seesawing with the Celtics for that top spot in the Eastern Conference, and it seems like a lot of their complementary players, like DeLon Wright, have really stepped up their game this year to make it so that they might be interesting. I still don't think that they can take the Cavs in a seven game series, but every year we see the Raptors being a quality team, and so maybe this is the year that they've got enough playoff experience under their belt that they're able to put together a run.
I don't know what this is going to mean in the second half as far as wear and tear on players and fatigue, but do you guys find it odd, Kush, too, the disparity in the schedule? Like, for example, Boston is 27-10. They've played 37 games. The Raptors are 23-9. They've only played 32 games, five fewer. That's a big number for this stage of the season for one team to play five fewer. The Cavs have played 24-10, so they've played three fewer. Does that seem odd to you that one team is already up to 37 games played when others are sitting there around 32? Milwaukee's 17-15. That's 32. The Heat have played 34, and I'm just adding teams up as I see them here. The Pistons have played 33 in 19-14, and they're set the Celtics at 37 games played. Does that mean somebody's going to have a really, really heavy stretch on the back end in order to catch up?
I certainly find it weird, but also I kind of wonder if it might have to do with the that they started the season a couple of weeks earlier this year, and so maybe they're still getting some wrinkles out in terms of workload on the teams. But I do think having the two extra weeks as a whole for the course of the season should make it so that they're better equipped for that, but there may be some disparities along the way, just as some of these teams getting some tough stretches knocked out early while they're still fresh. That may make that seven-game losing streak that the Pistons went on. We may be glad that was early on in the season rather than coming on late, because that's the type of thing that could really topple the momentum going into the back stretch.
Yeah, that's my entire point about this thing. It's, sure, a lot of times you have one team has played two more than another, but they'll make that up with a back-to-back next week or something of that nature, and you get right out. But there's a five-game separation between one team and several other teams there in the conference, and even in the Western Conference as well, and I just find that odd. Last thing on the Western Conference, Houston, Golden State. Have the Rockets made a legitimate case with Chris Paul and James Harden driving the way? Have they made a legitimate case that the Warriors could be in trouble of not getting back to their what would be fourth straight NBA finals?
Oh, you've certainly got to take them seriously. Anytime they've been putting up a performance like that, and also, they had already taken a bit of a mini jump last year, and so for them to elevate their play that much more this year, I think they've definitely got to be considered the most dangerous team to tackle the Warriors. And one piece who I think is really important for that is, the Warriors, they've always just kind of tossed a center out there, with Draymond Green being able to slide down to the five in most cases, but otherwise just taken someone just off of the waiver wire.
Yeah.
And the Rockets have seen some really great play from Clint Capella that could be a huge difference maker over the course of a series.
No question about it. We're talking to Steve Ensign, writing for DetroitBadBoys.com, a part of SB Nation, talking a little Pistons and then a little bit broader NBA. Listen, Steve, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate your time. I wish you again a happy new year just a few days early, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again coming up soon in 2018. All right?
Hey, sounds great. Always enjoy it.
Thank you. We appreciate the time. Steve Henson, DetroitBadBoys.com, with a little look at the Pistons, who are indeed on a winning run right now. They've won five out of their last six starts. We're going to get a timeout here, bottom of the hour Sports Center, coming your way. And after the bottom of the hour Sports Center, I want to talk a little bit more about the issue of race in the National Football League. One Detroit writer has claimed that the calls for Jim Caldwell's job have nothing to do with winning, has nothing to do with performance, trying to find a way to win a championship. Those who are calling for his job are just racists. It's a bold, bold statement, and one that I think he better doggone well be prepared to back up, or he's going to have to issue a huge apology to just vast numbers of Lions fans who simply want to win football games. So we'll talk about that. The context of race when it comes to African-American coaches in the National Football League coming up next, right here on The Ticket.
Now, be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
All right, rolling right along are we. It's 4:39. I'm going to take you for another 21 minutes of outstanding awesome. Then we're going to turn over to Mike Miller for drive time or to drive time. And, yeah, I want to get back to what I started the show with today at 3 o'clock. If you didn't, if you missed it, just give a, you know, give you a cursory little background.
It'll be up on the podcast site too later, 1065theticket.com, FYI.
Good call. Thank you for that. There was an op-ed that ran yesterday in the Free Press, Detroit Free Press. And it essentially said that fans who have been critical of Jim Caldwell as the Lions coach, particularly those who were calling for his job, are doing so primarily because, well, because he's black. They don't like his skin color. Not that they don't like his one-loss record. They don't like his skin color. And they're not ready to accept his one-loss record because of his skin color. That's essentially the point of the article. And, I mean, it's even really, you know, it's kind of played out in the headline. Detroit Lions coach Jim Caldwell's hot seat tied to racism. I find this to be the most provocative and, quite frankly, the most irresponsible type of journalism. Now, I don't know Joseph Hayes from Adam or Eve. I've never met him, never talked to him. I do know he's African-American. I do know in the article that he wrote yesterday, he laid out his own personal experiences with what he believed to be racist situations that he has experienced, and he is ready to project that onto criticism of an NFL head coach. Because Jim Caldwell has been so good, he argues, in Detroit, that it's impossible to criticize him without being a little bit racist. Because remember, all of the bad coaches that came before him, none of them were black, and now he comes in as a black guy and he's good, because he's got a plus 500 record, so therefore, if you are against Jim Caldwell, you just don't like black guys. That's, in essence, the argument that this gentleman named Joseph Hayes is making. Now, for his part in all of this, Jim Caldwell was asked about it at a press conference, and he essentially said, no, I disagree. And I'm going to let you hear this part of it, the tail end of the question asked by the assembled media. And then Jim, it's a little bit low. I'll try to crank this up as high as I can. Because Jim, and I'll talk about this part of it in a moment. Jim Caldwell being kind of a quiet, more reserved, very statesmanlike, very professional, not getting overly emotional, not shouting and yelling at people, but also not being just a grump like Bill Belichick. He's just a very understated man. So in his typical, casual, understated way, he denies that race has anything to do with any criticism that he is receiving as Lions head coach. So just give this a listen.
People that are here regularly has ever been unfair because of that reason?
No. Probably comes as a great surprise to you guys that I'll be any articles. If you are, I've never read any of your articles. Never heard of the radio, never. So all the stuff that you guys write and those kinds of as well as people nationally, I learned that lesson back in the 80s. So it's been a while, but no, I've never felt that way.
So again, my apologies for the lousy audio there. I just got that directly from the Free Press. The Detroit Free Press, of course. And Jim Caldwell, if you couldn't hear it over the ambient noise there, he said no. And then he said, quite frankly, no disrespect, but I don't read your stuff. He said to Carlos, I think it was Carlos Maneras who asked that question from the Free Press. He said, I don't read it. As good as you are, I don't read your stuff. I don't listen to the radio, and I don't listen to what people say about me on TV. It's just an old thing, and I don't do that. And so, but no, I've never felt like that. So his response, wrapped around the I don't listen to you guys, was no, I've never felt like I've been criticized because of my race. and then he repeated at the end. That was bookending the part about not listening. At the beginning and end of his response, he said, no, I have never felt that way. I am a big Jim Caldwell fan. I'm a fan of Jim Caldwell, the man. I'm a fan of Jim Caldwell because of his class. I'm a fan of Jim Caldwell because of his dignity. I'm a fan of Jim Caldwell because he is not among those who would play the race card when talking about his struggles. And yes, there have been struggles. Despite the fact, as Joseph Hayes is so quick to point out, that he has won more than previous coaches with the Lions in quite some time, it's also not enough. He has not won a playoff game in his 4 years. He's not going back to the playoffs this year, in large part due to an indefensible, and even Hayes admits that the loss to the Bengals this past weekend was indefensible. The Bengals are awful. They've got a coach who is on his way out the door, coincidentally, by the way, who is also African-American, but one who has kept his job for 15 years in Cincinnati despite never winning a playoff game. Forget about Caldwell with 4 years. How about Marvin Lewis? He hadn't won a playoff game in 15 years as a head coach. Many have been wondering what it takes to get fired in Cincinnati, because he's made the playoffs about half the years he's been there. He's 0-7 in those appearances. And some have said, you know, they've regressed and his message has gotten stale. What's it take to fire him? And a lot of people say that Mike Brown, the owner down there in Cincinnati, just wants the guy that will work for the cheapest. He doesn't want to have to fire him and pay him to not coach and then hire somebody else and pay him to coach. And so Marvin Lewis has gotten a free pass for a long time. But to my point, or to the larger point, Jim Caldwell, you know, as a head coach has had some success, but just not enough of it. The last time I checked, the goal wasn't to go 8-8 or 9-7. The last time I checked, the goal was to go into the playoffs, win playoff games, and advance toward a Super Bowl and an eventual championship. And for all of the progress they have made under Jim Caldwell, if they have hit a plateau, if they have hit a brick wall, if you will, and some fans or media point that out, that they're just not getting better 4 years into the Caldwell regime or Caldwell era, if somebody points out they're not getting better, they're doing so based on the fact that this is a, shall we say it again, results-oriented business. And nobody wants to advance from 5-11 to 8-8 and sit there. Now, to the point, I want to be very specific here. I'm going to read some of the praise from Joseph Hayes' article in the Free Press. Let's go back to 2014, he says, when Caldwell took over. The Lions had just missed the playoffs the past two seasons, winning 11 games total. Prized quarterback Matthew Stafford was seen as a bust by many Lions fans, while others thought he was regressing under former coach Jim Schwartz. I would put my hand in the air and say I agree with that. In stepped Caldwell. Among lies and erroneous media reports that said the Lions had settled for him after striking out on the coach they really wanted, it was a fitting start to the overall negativity. So already he was accusing the media of being negative about Jim Caldwell from the time he was hired. And that's because of race, too? It was a fitting start to the overall negativity Caldwell would experience in the years that followed, he writes. In his first season with the team, Caldwell led the Lions to their second-best record in franchise history, 11-5. He was one crazy, picked-up pass interference call away from leading the team to its first playoff win in two decades. Fair enough. It was very successful. And I'm going to pause here and editorialize my own self in response to the article, to the op-ed. If Jim Caldwell had built upon that 11-5 and gone 11-5 again and marched right back to where they left off and advanced and, let's say, had won a playoff game, we are not talking about this right now. We're not. But the truth of the matter is there wasn't a progression from that point of an 11-5 start. There was not a progression. Sadly and unfortunately, there has been regression since that time. And to the point where we are today, you know, with the team sitting with 8 wins and hopefully could finish 9-7 with a win over Green Bay, but it means nothing because they frittered away their chances at going to the playoffs with this loss to Cincinnati. This is current. 2014 is now ancient history as far as the fans in 2017 NFL goes. 2014 and that 11-win season, you know, I don't mean to be crass and rude here, but this is a what-have-you-done-for-me-lately business. And not because he's black. We'll come back to that. He never had a honeymoon, writes Hayes. The Lions got off to a slow start the next season before regrouping, and ever since fans have called for his removal. Now, I will completely disagree with that. I can't speak for every fan in the city of Detroit, or even every fan in the region of Northwest Ohio. But I don't think fans were calling for his removal the second season. I think fans started to wonder whether they were making progress enough last season. And I think this season, after the season got off to such a tremendous start, winning their first two games impressively over Arizona and the New York Giants, before then losing 4 out of 5, that's when people said, okay, we just extended, we the Lions, if you recall. They announced the extension of Jim Caldwell's contract when, Jim? Wasn't it right after the Giants win? Wasn't it like right after week two?
Yeah, except that it had already been technically on the Lions' books. They had actually done it earlier, right? They had been announced, exactly.
Yeah,
we covered that.
The fans had not been made aware of that.
Right,
so the fans
we covered
made aware
that, yep.
After week two, when they're 2-0, and if you recall, Jim, they were cracking the top 10 in a lot of NFL power rankings among the various media outlets.
We were getting into the time where even we here on this program were saying you can't be blowing this and not at least making it back to the playoffs start.
And advancing, maybe to the second round at this point. But then right after they made that announcement, they end up losing 4 of their next 5 games. And then they get on the 3-game winning streak against weakened Green Bay minus Aaron Rodgers, the pathetic Cleveland Browns, and the reeling, but better than Cleveland, but still the last place Chicago Bears. They win 3 in a row. And it's like, okay, now you got Minnesota and Baltimore. You've got to hold serve there and win at least one of those, and then take care of business against the weak rest of the schedule: Tampa Bay, Chicago, Cincinnati, and Green Bay. And what happens? They lose to Minnesota. They lose to Baltimore. And then they have to win 4 in a row. And they can't because of Cincinnati. And so fans rightfully getting very frustrated with this. Why? Because of the skin tone of the man in the ball cap at the press conference, or because of the results? It is a results-oriented business.
Can I jump in on this, too? Because
real quick, because I wanted to finish more of what Joseph Hayes wrote.
Okay, finish what he had to write first. No. Finish what he had to write first.
Well, there was a lot more, but just this particular rest of this paragraph was, when they lost, it was because of him. For a man only one win away from having 3 winning seasons in his first 4 years, it's shocking to see the disrespect people have for him as they mock and laugh at his personality and call him a bum and unfit. Again, I'm not up in Detroit, Jim, but I talk to Detroit fans, and I hear from Detroit fans, and I read social media from Detroit fans, as a course of what we do every day on this business, in this business, and I hear people talking about results. I hear people call Jim Caldwell boring, and guess what? He is. He's a boring guy. He's not dynamic and energetic. He doesn't have the perfect soundbite the way a Mike Tomlin might.
Yeah.
The way a Sean Payton might. The way that, some of the younger coaches in the NFL do. He doesn't have that wit. He doesn't have that kind of dynamic personality.
If you're going to be boring, you have to somehow pull off the Belichick to make it work.
That's true. But that nobody calls him a bum that I'm aware of. Nobody calls him unfit. I think this writer is trying to personalize his own experiences due to his race. And he says he's experienced racism in his own life. And he goes on to describe various situations in doctor's offices and situations in which he himself took over the sports section for his newspaper and was ridiculed. And he can't do this and that sort. He's taking his own personal experiences and projecting them out to Jim Caldwell. When I don't think I've heard anybody say anything negative about Jim Caldwell other than win me more games, get me to the playoffs, win me a playoff game. If he would win playoff games at the level Bill Belichick does, you see how well he does with his personality. Nobody has a problem with it. It's simply a matter of winning. And I feel like this is just very, very 2017 of this writer to start a race war within the context of Honolulu Blue. Making it about black and white, telling Lions fans and Lions media that they're being too hard on Jim Caldwell because he's black, accusing somebody of being a racist because of the way they root for their football team is just a very, very negative and dangerous thing to do in 2017 that, quite frankly, Jim, I don't think we need, and I think this man owes Lions fans everywhere and media an apology for this blatant attempt to racially divide. Go ahead, make your point.
You know, where I come down on this is, and you asked when you first brought this up in our opening segment, when you brought this up, you asked if me and Chris Lemieux, who I had on the program while filling in for you yesterday, our great friend from Pride of Detroit.
Yes.
And we obviously at some point got to the Jim Caldwell, you know, what's going to happen, you know, with the extensions for 1 year, and if it looks like they're not going to make the playoffs now, et cetera, and so on. First of all, never once did this article or this concept come up. And quite frankly, when we were talking about it, you know, he's a likable guy. The players do play for him. And the gist of it, Bob, is I got to a point where I asked Chris, and obviously the front office of Quinn and them has been there less time than Caldwell has now been head coach. But it got to the point where I started thinking, you know, when is it on some of the guys and what they're doing, you know, in the front office? Perfect example. Zeke Ansah, right? He's going to be a free agent after this probable last game, since this is probably it, this Sunday. He had 14 and a half sacks back in 2015. These last two seasons combined, 11, and only two this season. Haloti Ngata, a veteran, which I believe the Quinn guys brought in. He doesn't look like he has much left in the tank. Defensive, you know, front line needs to be more or less overhauled.
Offensive line has had some injury problems.
How many times things? Have we brought up the running back thing? We got to the point where both Chris and I agreed if we get past around the third round of the draft, we'll be mad at the Lions if they haven't taken a running back
absolutely
with one of their first three picks.
That's not right. They put all of their eggs into the Matthew Stafford basket and felt like anybody can run. If Abdullah can stand up, he can run and be good.
Well, that's proven false. So my point is, yes, there might be some underperforming with some of the talent they have on the field, but there are some issues and holes still on this team. And when does, even though they're newer relative to Caldwell, when does Bob Quinn in the front office start taking some heat for this? Because they got to improve those positions,
amen,
or we're looking at 8-8, 9-7 in that
and
ballpark
again. That's not
again
good enough. You know, 11-5
right
to start his career was great. Now 7-9 was terrible. 9-7 last year was okay, and he made it to the wild card and lost again, and now to miss the playoffs. It has been regression from year one to year four. It hasn't been progression. It has been regression. And you don't need to look at a man's skin to see the numbers. And that is all this is all about. Jim, do me a favor. Reach out. See if we can get a conversation with Mr. Hayes for tomorrow's program, because I would love to have this conversation about sports and records and results as it pertains to coaches taking heat, if you will, rather than about the color of their skin. I would love to have that conversation with Joseph Hayes tomorrow. So a little on-air staff meeting here, Jim. Get me this guy on the radio. All right, that's it. That's all the time we've got. Drive Time is coming up next. Thanks for listening to the show and being a part of it today. We'll see you tomorrow right here on The Ticket. Bye-bye.